is a preview of heaven too. It's one of those things in life that God gives us to kind of tell us what we have to look forward to. It's an incredible blessing to have a godly marriage. And if you would open to Ephesians 5, I'll show you why I say that, why I say marriage is a preview of heaven as well. In Ephesians 5, it's a passage that we use very frequently when we talk about marriage. Because Paul taught some things that are really, really clear. It's such a practical passage concerning marriage. Verse 22 there in Ephesians 5. Look at what Paul is illustrating with marriage. He said, "Wives, submit to your own husbands as to the Lord, for the husband is the head of the wife, as Christ is the head of the church, his body, and is himself its Savior. Now as the church submits to Christ, so also wives should submit in everything to their husbands. Husbands, love your wives as Christ loved the church and gave himself up for her, that he might sanctify her, having cleansed her by the washing of water with the word, so that he might present the church to himself in splendor, without spot or wrinkle or any such thing, that she might be holy and without blemish." Verse 28. "In the same way, husbands should love their wives as their own bodies. He who loves his wife loves himself, for no one ever hated his own flesh, but nourishes and cherishes it, just as Christ does the church, because we're all members of his body. Therefore, a man shall leave his father and mother and hold fast to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh." This mystery is profound, and I'm saying that it refers to Christ and the church. "However, let each one of you love his wife as himself, and let the wife see that she respects her husband." Now, this morning, we're going to go back kind of the text we were at last week. And if we have time, we're going to look at what love and submission are. If not, we'll look at that tonight. But Ephesians 5 does give this really clear teaching about the church. And it's important to note that, about marriage, it's important to note that what he's really teaching about here is Christ and the church. And he's using marriage to illustrate the relationship between Christ and the church. We'll talk about that more later this morning or tonight, depending on how far we get. But also, the teaching is just so profound. I love in verse 32, where he repeats what we read in Genesis. You know, the husband will leave his father and mother and cleave to his wife, and the two shall become one flesh. That's an incredible statement. He himself says, this mystery is profound. That's an incredible statement. You know, there's a lot of ways in which that's true of marriage. When a man and a wife come together sexually, they become one flesh. When a man and a wife become married, they come together spiritually. They become one spiritual flesh. And you guys may have seen this in older couples. If you guys have seen any couples who have been married for 50 or plus, you know, years, and they start to finish each other's sentences, they start to tell and laugh at the same jokes, they start to say the exact same things. You know, dads tend to repeat the same story over and over and over. And when couples have been married long enough, you've noticed that moms start doing it too. You know, it continues to go on. And that union is one that I don't know that on earth we'll ever completely understand, because it's so similar to what happens to a Christian when we become Christians, right? I mean, Romans 6, it describes so well what happens to a human being when we become a Christian. You know, there are a few times in a person's life that we become a new creature. I don't know if y'all have ever thought about salvation that way, but when we're born, we become a new creature, right? A baby. We continue to grow and we develop, but children are still children. You know, people are still people. We're growing, but we're not really becoming a new creature. Then we become baptized, and we put to death the body of sin, and we rise to walk in newness of life. And then we become married. And when we become married, we come together, and we become one flesh, a new creature, no longer just a man or just a woman, but now a married couple. And then when we die, we're transformed, and I haven't died yet, so I'm not exactly sure what that's like. But we're transformed, and in some manner, we become a new creature, a creature that can survive in the midst of the eternal and glorious nature of God himself. Marriage is one of those incredible times. Just like with baptism, we put to death that body and rise to walk in newness of life. With marriage, we put something to death and we rise to walk in newness of marriage. Now last week, and if you turn to 1 Samuel 25, we looked at a passage in 1 Samuel 25, and we targeted husbands. Last week's sermon was one that my wife liked a lot. Because we made the point that husbands, you know, should remember that that anger is rarely wise from this passage. We made the point that listening is critical in a marriage. I mean, you really need to listen. And also that, that changing your heart is not unmanly. And we looked at that from this passage in 1 Samuel 25. If you weren't here last week, I'd encourage you to go home and read it. It's one of those accounts that's really, it's entertaining, but it's also really insightful. If you were here, then you probably remembered the gist of what happened. I'll sum it up. But David was anointed king. He came in the wilderness, and as he was in the wilderness, he was protecting people, you know, specifically his tribesmen. And among those people that he was protecting were some shepherds, some people from Nabal's camp, Nabal's household. So David came to this man, Nabal, whom Scripture tells us was a Calebite. He was rash. He was an angry man. And he said, "It's a feast. Give me some food for my following, for my army." And Nabal, his servant, said he railed at David's men. He responded in abusive anger to David's men. So the servants went back, and they told David. And David started blustering in the wilderness. You know, "This time tomorrow, all of the men in Nabal's household will be dead." David said, "I'm going to go in and wipe them out." Well, Nabal's servants went and told his wife, Abigail. "Abigail, David sent some men to ask for some, basically what we had at hand so that he could feed his men on a feast day." And Nabal railed at them. And Abigail, secretly, without telling Nabal, went and took some of their possessions, went and met David in the wilderness, and said in verse 24, "On me, my Lord, alone be this guilt. Take these gifts." She said, "You don't want this blood guilt on your hands. You know, when God does to you everything that he said he'll do to you, you don't want to look back and say, 'Hey, I killed Nabal and his household. I slay,' you know, that's not blood guilt you want on their hands. Don't seek salvation for yourself, but let the Lord avenge you, you know, and take this gift." And David changed his heart. David, instead of going in and wiping out Nabal and his family and his household, he refrained from that punishment, trusted God to take care of it, and when Nabal did die 10 days later, he married Abigail himself. So this morning, with that account in mind, I'd like to look at Abigail. Wives, this lesson is primarily for you, but husbands, there's going to be a couple things we'll address with you as well. But I want to look here at Abigail. Abigail, we're told from the beginning, was a beautiful and discerning woman. Now, at one point, I was sitting in a Bible class, I was about 19, and I heard the teacher start talking about this account, 1 Samuel 25, he's talking about Abigail. And as we were reading through the text, he came to the part, look in verse 24 and 25. This is 1 Samuel 24 and 25. "Abigail came to David, fell at his feet, and said, 'On me alone, my Lord, be the guilt. Please let your servant speak in your ears and hear the words of your servant. Let not my Lord regard this worthless fellow Nabal, for as his name is, so is he. Nabal is his name, and folly is with him. But I, your servant, did not see the young men of my Lord whom you sent me.'" So he came to this passage in this text. And he asked the question, does Abigail's behavior, is it consistent with what we learn about marriage roles in the New Testament? For example, love and submission. And again, I'm going to take a break from 1 Corinthians 7 tonight if we don't get there right now, but is it consistent with what we read about love and submission? Now, we just read Ephesians 5. It says, "Husbands, love your wives. Wives, submit to your husbands." Look at 1 Timothy chapter 2. In 1 Timothy 2, it's another one of those passages with some practical teaching about marriage. And in verse 8, we read a little bit about men. It says, I desire that in every place that men should pray, lifting holy hands without anger or quarreling. Verse 9, likewise also that women should adorn themselves in respectable apparel with modesty and self-control, not with braided hair and gold or pearls or costly attire, but with what is proper for women who profess godliness, with good works. Let a woman learn quietly with all submissiveness. I do not permit a woman to teach or exercise authority over a man. Rather, she's to remain quiet. For Adam was formed first and then Eve, and Adam was not deceived, but the woman was deceived and became a transgressor. She will be saved through childbearing if they continue in faith and love and holiness with self-control. Passages like these, and there's a couple, including Ephesians 5, have again passages about which there's some debate. You know, we live in a culture that's in an interesting phase, I think. You know, in And my parents and my grandparents and their grandparents' cultures, as they were growing up, you know, they lived at a time where, like, women were just always quiet, never said anything, always, you know, that was the idea of what a good woman was. Now this morning I want us to ask, is that what a godly woman is? Does that fit that idea? Or think about it on the other hand. Look at Proverbs 31, for example. I would encourage you to go home and read this whole passage. Proverbs 31. I think this morning I won't quite have time to read it all. But if you were to read Proverbs 31 to somebody, and you were not to mention gender, they would almost always think you're talking about a husband. Look, for example, at verse 14. Try to read this without thinking about gender. She is like the ships of the merchant. She brings food from afar. She rises while it's yet night and provides food for her household and portions for her maiden. She considers a field and buys it. With the fruit of her hand, she plants a vineyard. She dresses herself with strength and makes her arms strong. And the proverb goes on to describe a woman who is working and active and has a measure of you know, ability and strength. And like I said, you know, especially in generations, not that many generations, but generations past, these have been characteristics that have almost always been attributed to men. If you talked about breadwinners, you talked about men. If you talked about working, you were talking about the husband. If you talked about, you know, in Proverbs 31 especially, talks about how she interacts with the children, you had talked about the man. And, you know, that's true. Godly men have roles in all of those things too. But the context of Proverbs 31 is Solomon's mom telling him what to look for in a wife. This is the wisest man who's ever lived looking for a checklist to do in his wife. He was looking for a godly woman. You know, Ephesians 5 talks about a godly woman. 1 Timothy 2 talks about a godly woman. And I think that's one point that I want to make about women, about wives, is you've got a really hard job, wives. You have a very difficult job, just like with men, it's a job that's full of blessing. But it's a difficult job, because submission doesn't mean that you don't matter. It doesn't mean that you have less value. Submission actually means you have some backbone. Let me explain what I mean. A lot of influences in the world want women to believe that all that matters is sex appeal. Well, godly wives, you've got to have the backbone to stand up and say, no, all that matters is godliness. A lot of people are going to want to convince you that all that matters is pursuing your goals, being all that you can be, finishing, you know, a higher education, maybe establishing some kind of career for yourself. And wives, you've got to have the backbone to stand up and say, no, all that matters is getting my family to heaven, even if I carry them there. You know? That takes a lot of strength to be a godly wife. And those things may not be inconsistent with that. You may be able to get your family to heaven and still practice all of those things, but Abigail, for example, was not being an ungodly wife when she went to David and told him what she told him. For one, she was being honest. She was just being frank. Nabal was a foolish man. His name literally meant fool. And it's likely that the writer here, or maybe even Nabal's peers, gave him that as a nickname. It may not have even been his real name, but they, knowing him, said, this is a good description of this man. The other thing that Abigail did is after she went and talked to David, she went back and she told Nabal what she had done. I have enormous sympathy for women who are married to men who are abusive, who maybe let their anger get out of control or get drunk. We're told in the text that when she went back home, Nabal was drunk, his heart was merry with wine. And we know that he was abusively angry. He railed at David's men. What did it take for her to go back to her husband and say, I know what you said, but I went and I gave David, I did the right thing anyway. It took strength. It took strength, didn't it? And it's not like she was hiding it from him anymore. She went back and she told him what she'd done. And if Abigail were an ungodly woman, then do you think that David, the man after God's own heart, would have swooped in and taken her for his wife at his first available opportunity? I mean, he noted, I mean, in verse 32 and 33, David literally said, "Blessed be your discretion, your wisdom, your ability to see the battlefield differently, and blessed be you who've kept me this day from blood guilt." David saw that in her and admired it. And really, this goes back to wives in general, what wives were created for, and who wives, or the role that wives were meant to keep. I'll try to be brief with this, but look real quickly back at Genesis chapter 1. In Genesis 1, this is a passage that many of us are familiar with, so I'm going to point out some verses, and again, I trust you to read it in context on your own time. But in Genesis 1, God created the earth. He created, I mean, thing after thing after thing, light, you know, earth, the plants of the field, the birds, the creatures that crawl, and after each, he said, "It is good. It is good. It is good." Now, we tend to think about creation, and we tend to think that the first thing that wasn't good was sin, but really, God himself said something's not good before sin even happened. And this is something I think that I've pointed out here before, but look at Genesis chapter 2 and verse 18. The Lord said, "It is not good that man should be alone. I will make him a helper fit for him." Why would God create a problem? Who created man? God created man alone. And before sin ever happened, God looked down and said, "It's not good that man should be alone. So I'll create a helper fit for him." And I think it's kind of entertaining what God had Adam do next. He had him go through all of the creatures in the garden and name them. And then it says, "When there was not found a helper suitable for Adam." But don't you think God knew from the start that a dog could not be the companion Adam needed? You know, a bird could not be the companion that Adam needed. God said, why would God have him do that? Well, God made him do it so that he would appreciate his wife when God created her. God made Adam from dirt. God made Eve from a piece of Adam, didn't he? He put Adam to sleep. He took from Adam a part of his own body, and he created woman. And when Adam woke up and saw Eve, what did he say in verse 23? "This at last is bone of my bones and flesh of my flesh. She shall be called woman because she was taken out of man." You can almost hear the surprise, the joy in his voice as he looked at literally the most beautiful woman in existence, the only woman in existence, and said, "This at last is bone of my bone and flesh of my flesh." A helper suitable for him. And what was there for Eve to help Adam with? You know, sure, there was the stuff around the garden. He was to keep the garden. But Eve's job was to help Adam continue serving God and living with him. And who did Satan target? The helper. I heard one time a preacher make the point, or try to make the point, that Satan, the serpent, targeted Eve because she was weaker, and I cringed. Because for one, 2 or 1 Timothy 2 doesn't say that woman is the weaker vessel. It says, "Men, treat your wives like honor her, like you might treat something fragile." But he didn't target Eve because she was weak. He targeted her because she was the helper. Think about it in these terms. If you were to build like a house, and I, by the way, I know this isn't how construction is done, but if you were told to build a house, your job is to take part A and put it up next to part B. And so you have all these parts. You wouldn't know what to do with them because you wouldn't have the blueprints, the tools. So you might hire someone to help you to look at the blueprints and the tools and tell you how to put part A and part B together. If someone wanted to mess up your house, all they'd have to do is attack your helper, right? All they'd have to do is change the blueprint or give you a different tool. That's what Satan did with Eve. He said, let's try and derail God's whole plan, not realizing that God's plan was working from before time began. Derail God's whole plan by messing up the helper, and we can mess up man. You know, it says Eve was deceived in 1 Timothy 2. Adam just took the fruit and ate. She gave it to her husband who was nearby, and he ate also. So wives should be helpers. Let's look real quickly at how Abigail was a good example of a helper. What was it that David, this godly man, saw in this woman? Strength. That's right. Yeah, he saw strength. Look at Proverb 21. We made the point last week that anger is destructive in husbands. Husbands, don't be given to anger. Anger is rarely wise. There are a lot of proverbs that have to do with the same in mothers and women. Look at Proverbs 21, for example, in verse 19. Proverbs are simple sayings. It's part of why I like them. But look at this. It says, it's better to live in a desert land than with a quarrelsome and fretful woman. It's better to live in a desert land than with a quarrelsome and fretful woman. Women have every bit as much potential in a family to do damage to that family through anger as men do. I think sometimes men get the bad rap there when there's abuse or anger, but the truth, when a woman, a mother, or a wife is angry or abusive, it's just as destructive. You know, we made the point to husbands, listen. It's important to listen to your wives. This is something I made with myself in mind. I have a hard time listening to my wife from time to time. But on the other hand, look at what Abigail did. She communicated well. She communicated not just well, but in a manner that reflected her knowledge of her husband, right? She came home, and she had this information that was critical to their family. David was going to sweep in and murder them. That's critical information, important information, and yet she waited, it seems, at least a whole night to tell him why. Because she understood that that was a bad time to communicate that to him. When I was a really little kid, like between the ages of 7 and 9, I lived right next door to my granddaddy and my grandmother. I'd go over every day. My grandmother would make me a sandwich that was banana bread with cake icing in between. And for the record, there's probably some full-grown adults here who weighed less than I did at 10. But I'd sit there and I'd eat my sandwich, and my grandmother would say, "How was your day?" And I would say, "Good." And she would say, "Well, what did you do?" And I would say, "Go to school." And then one time she said, "Tommy, when a woman asks you a question, she wants more than an answer." And my granddaddy said, "And when a man asks you a question, he almost always wants yes or no." It's important not just that husbands listen, but that wives communicate well. You know, it's kind of stereotypical. I realize not all marriages may be like this, but husbands tend to have a one-track mind. When we're in something, whether it's work or recreation or we're busy, it's probably not the best time to talk to us about kids at school and things like that. I know a couple that had to make a rule. After we get into bed, there's no more talking, because he would fall asleep and the next day she'd be buying a new slide for the kids and he'd say, "Why did we buy a new slide? I talked about it last night." You know, the wives need to know when it's, you know, how to communicate with their husbands, and that's something that takes time over the course of your marriage. And we said, husbands, you need to be able to change your heart. Changing your heart is not unmanly. Sometimes we get in man zone and we think, I have to stick with what I'm thinking. But wives, you need to always be a heartbreaker, because sometimes that's what it takes to get through to a man's hard heart. I like how Abigail, in chapter 25 and verse 37, she came back and she told Nabal, and it showed the effective timing of her communication, because it says when he heard it, he became as stone. What would it take for someone to communicate with a man like Nabal, a rash, angry, drunken man who is worthless and foolish by his own servants and wives and mission? What would it take? It would take the discretion of a woman like Abigail. And wives, you need to try to mirror that when you communicate with your husbands, because, you know, sometimes husbands will make decisions that are bad. We're humans. We're human beings too. And sometimes husbands will try to stick the course that's in their mind, and you need to be able to, in the right way, steer them in a godly manner. I like how Peter wrote about wives in 1 Peter 3, 1 through 6, and we'll pick up there tonight as we continue to discuss love and submission. But he wrote that wives should behave in a respectful and pure conduct toward their husbands. You know, the example of a godly wife is so powerful that sometimes she can win her husband over to Christ or to other things without even speaking, just by being a godly woman. And so if you're here this morning and you're a husband, or you're thinking about getting married, or you have been, I'd like to encourage you to continue to try to be the kind of man that Christ was. If you're a wife, or you have been, or you're thinking about it, I'd like to encourage you to try to strive to be the kind of woman that is a godly woman, like Abigail, for example. And this morning we only briefly talked about what to do to be saved. We referenced